Hello and welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
And I'm Crystal.
And guess what, Crystal? You know what? Well, everyone what? Knows what. We're not going to talk about a specific book specifically. We're going to have a guest. We have a guest. We have a guest who's listening to all of this preamble. I think we thought it would be fun to actually talk to, again, some of our colleagues in New York Public Library and see what's up with them and what they're doing and how they're doing it. I always find that interesting, don't you?
Yes, very.
Okay, good. We're on the same page. So today, everybody, we have Julie Golia, who is the curator of History, Social Sciences, and Government Information. Wow. Hi, Julie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course. That's quite a title.
It's a lot. It's a mouthful. It barely fits on one line.
Is your office at the main, at the 42nd Street?
I am. I'm based out of the Schwarzman Building, but okay. I'm one of these curators. There's, lots of curators at the library, but I'm in a, I think, lovely cohort of curators who are not division-based, we're subject-based. And the cool thing about that is that I get to work all across the different research libraries and all of the different collections and divisions, which is where I like to be.
Yeah, I was looking at the hierarchy, because there's so many people who work for New York Public Library, and to see where you fell in there, and it was surprising to see you in collections, because you're under that line. Which is really interesting, actually.
Yeah, so one of the things that I do, I do a lot of different things, but one of them is that I get to pick the books on my subject that we bring into the research collections, which is a pretty remarkable thing if you think about it. We get to essentially decide what books related to American and European history will be in New York Public Library's collections in perpetuity.
So you're the one. Okay.
All the power.
Now I know where to go and there's something that's not in the catalog now.
That's right. Like, come to me and I'll help you out. Exactly.
Oh, okay. It's always good to have connections. It's amazing how big this library is, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's sort Indeed. Of interesting about doing this.
Indeed.
I want to ask you so many things, but please tell us about your fascinating journey to the New York Public Library. Starting with your earliest memory.
in my mother's womb. No. Well, interestingly, I think I'm a historian. I'm not a librarian. I always joke that I'm librarian adjacent and have such a love of librarians. And so I got my PhD in history. But I think, being a historian is more than a degree. And I feel like in some ways, I feel like I was a historian since maybe my earliest waking moment of being a historian was maybe my teens, my early teens. I remember going up to on like a family trip to Poughkeepsie. And we went to the FDR house, and then we went to Fishkill, which is Eleanor Roosevelt's house, and thinking a little bit about gender history and ways that we remember a president, a male sort of public figure, and then the ways that we think about the women who is sort of had such an influence on his life. And I would say that's like my earliest memory of thinking about gender and history and what the things that we remember and prioritize and record and the things that we don't. And then I studied history in college and I spent a couple of years working in documentary film and I worked in a really wonderful movie about the history of Tupperware. And then I got my PhD at Columbia, but the whole time I was there, I kind of felt like maybe I didn't want to be a professor. I envisioned a broader audience for the kind of history that I wanted to do. And so when I graduated, I went into the fields of library and museums. I worked at the New York Historical Society for a little while. I spent a wonderful decade at the Brooklyn Historical Society, which is now part of the Brooklyn Public Library system. And I arrived at the library in the auspicious month of February 2020. And spent a few weeks on site until COVID hit. And an interesting thing about that, I will say, is that I got to work on a lot of different things as a curator. And one of the last exhibitions I worked on at Brooklyn Historical Society was a history of public health in Brooklyn. We looked at 400 years of sickness and health. And what a wild time to come into a collecting position at a foremost collecting institution and start to think about what it means to collect around this historical period. So actually, that's one of the major things I've been doing since I started here is how do we collect and preserve the era that we're living through now?
Wow, that really is interesting. I know you're working on a bunch of projects. This is a crazy question because it's probably too broad and too weird, but you just said something that I think about all the time lately, especially, is when you collect history and you go through all the material and stuff like that, like in your training, like do you have an eye or a sense or a method about how you look at history as it's told by another historian, I guess, which is material that the library might collect, and figure out where they're coming from, like if there's a bias, if there's a perspective, if there is something that adds to the conversation that doesn't add to the conversation. I mean, when you said what you said about FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt, it's sort of like a very intriguing way as a young person to look at what you were looking at. And that was something that just happened in your brain, it seemed, and gave you this perspective. And history could have been written multiple ways about them and has. How do you go through all this to find the truth, shall we say? To use a crazy word that, what does it mean?
Yes, I know. We historians do not consider truth to be among our currencies. And actually, we have a very complicated relationship with the notion of facts as well. But you're right, that's a huge question. It's almost the question, if you will, if you're getting right to the nub of all that that we do. So I think so I will say first that there's a longstanding sort of debate and a very complicated relationship with the notion of objectivity in history. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, this is something that is often held up, like in journalism, for example, as a paragon to strive to. And I think one thing that historians historically have struggled with is the idea of objectivity. Mm-hmm. It's just something I think about in my own research as well. Objectivity itself has almost a gendered nature to it, right? Like the notion mm-hmm. of a very fact-based, hard news, approach, it feeling almost male, right? And then the idea of kind of like a subjective opinion, emotionally wrought kind of concept of truth being a female thing, right? So even that idea has a gendered history in and of itself. But I think one thing that maybe like a teenage Julie was doing up there in Poughkeepsie is I was looking and thinking about the notion of silences in our historical record. And in my job right now, I think really deeply about the notion of silences in the archives. What have we chosen to collect? And what have we chosen not to collect? And there's great power in that, in ways that can be deeply problematic. And if we look at collecting institutions really across history, across the country, across the world, you know, so many more things haven't been preserved than have been preserved. And so from my perspective as a curator, I think one of my major roles is to think about the reparative nature of the work that I do. How can we locate those silences? How can we seek to fill them? In some ways, that may mean deprioritizing something that the library specializes in, which is textual material, to think about things like oral histories, right? And to think about the different ways that different communities pass down and tell their stories. And then, of course, to think about how to empower communities to also preserve their own story. These materials don't necessarily have to come to the New York Public Library or even to a collecting institution, but ways that communities can recognize their own record as historically significant and be empowered to preserve it themselves.
Wow, you come prepared. You know what you're doing. Crystal, what's going on over with you? Do you have any questions for Julie?
Well, I mean, I love that because I feel like a lot of an older way of thinking about libraries and librarianship is this idea of like neutrality, right? We just kind of like let this information flow to us and flow out to other people. But I think there's this kind of active engagement that needs to happen that clearly you're doing and a lot of library workers are doing. And I think that's really important in sorts of in like assessing a lot of historical things and the information that comes across to us, because if we are just being neutral, like it's never really neutral, right? Because certain things have more power, certain things are pushed forward more, and we have to take this kind of active role in thinking about the information that we collect and give out to people too.
Crystal, I think the parallels there to librarianship are actually really significant, because when we think about what a librarian does on a daily basis, so much of that has to be rooted in the community and rooted in empathy, right? And I think there's a way that that feels like, oh, well, historians shouldn't think with their emotions and feel with their emotions and analyze with their emotions. And I actually take a different approach to my work and to collecting work, which is, what does it mean to go into your work with empathy, to meet people where they are, right? It's hard work and it's long-term work. It's something that librarians do every day. And I think it's something that my field in a lot of ways can learn so much from.
I often think about the library degree itself as, you know, it does give you obviously some skills and technical stuff, but I think of it as a process you go through to show that you care about what you do in the most basic way. And I would think absolutely someone can earn that degree on the job or in some other way as well, in a very general sense. I didn't know when I asked you the first question, I didn't realize what I was leading to, but now I do, because it's been on my mind too lately about truth and news and objectivity. And I read a tweet by a mom that I retweeted on Jefferson Market's Twitter, how she said her son stopped getting his news from social media like a young kid and read 5 books and his anxiety is gone.
Wow.
And I've always thought like reading a book can be an anxiety reducer. Of course, the subject matter could be anxiety making, but there's something about communing with that book that there's no other intrusion. There's no other conversation. It's between you and that author and that content. And I find something very pleasing about that, or very stabilizing. And you, what you just said, Julie, I realize, being the elder statesman that I am, when I was younger, I craved sort of what the internet promised, which was a dismantling of the ivory tower, like the gatekeepers, so to speak, even though librarians were gatekeepers, that the regular guy could write an article for the New Yorker and not have to go through jump through hoops and stuff. I dreamed of writing for the New Yorker. And then, of course, a lot of that did happen, like with the internet, like social media is news. I mean, the nightly news will refer to social media as a source. It's become completely crazily democratized. And we know in some ways it's become this crazy inferno of misinformation and just nutsiness. Hearing you speak, it made me realize I now am going back to that yearning for someone who cares and who is diligent and who has some sort of ethic, some sort of, like I said about librarianship, someone who cares to tell as best as they can, in the best way they can, what they're seeing is happening. And you just sort of said that. You know what I mean? I want now you to be in charge of United States media. Do you mind?
I'm on it. It's actually going to do right after this podcast. I'm heading over there right now.
I mean, it's not a big deal. It's not a big job, but I sort of realized now I want librarians and historians and curators to come together and say, you know, we're going to focus this for you and really care and do the best we can. So there's not a lot of this crazy conversation that's making this teenage boy anxious. And now he's reading these 5 books, hopefully good ones, and is mentally calmer and maybe more focused. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that the nub of what you're saying is that the internet moves at such an unbelievably rapid pace. The nature of discourse in an internet saturated world moves at an almost, you can't almost can't see it pace, right? the fundamental nature of, for example, archival research is the opposite, right? It is, you go into an archive for months and months to learn, to really immerse yourself in something. One of the things that people don't always realize about doing history work is that 90% of what you see when you're doing that research is a dead end. It's deeply frustrating. It is not sexy. It is like, it is tough and deadening in some ways. I have some funny stories about, they're doing the research for my book about, you know, going outside to the light, you know, oh my God. But there's very little space for that in the world that we live in today, do you know? And I think, you know, I feel actually one of the kind of the groups that I feel worse for is journalists who really enjoy that like long form immersive research experience of journalism. And those who actually have the capacity to do that are few and far between and deeply privileged, right? It is a deep privilege to have an editor who says, go for a few weeks and just wow. dig into something, right? So it is, I mean, I actually write a lot about the internet in my own research. And it is, there are many great things about the internet. But that is to me, one of the things I that makes me sad about the speed of the world that we live in is that we're losing that fundamental skill, which by the way, you know, to your earlier point, Frank, should not be only for the trained historian to do. I actually think one of the most important things that we can do is bring, students studying, you know, pharmacology, you know, into the library and teach them how to do document analysis on 18th, 19th, 20th century documents. So many different young people can get so much out of that experience, even if their plan is not to be a historian.
You know, that's been an age-old library thing, and especially now more than ever is it important, because I think about the quality, the question of time, that, oh, I just don't have time to do a deep dive. Well, you do. You owe it to yourself. I mean, like reading magazines, like I subscribe to paper periodicals, which I never did in my whole life, but I do now because I want that experience of reading a longer form article and saying, I can focus on this one niche subject right now because it's important to focus and then go from there. The internet forces you to skitter around wildly, but to get that message across, especially to younger people, has always been a challenge in the library, but a good one and a worthy one. And I see it. You will get those kids who realize that, oh yes, this is where this stuff is at. This is where the real stuff is. And if you just focus and make some time for it, it's like getting that sense of like you have the time. It's for your brain. It's worth it. It'll pay off. I didn't think we'd get so deep here. But you did mention your research on a book, if I can move on to this, because I also love librarians or people who work in the library who also create. I mean, that's sort of the dream. Like I try to cultivate that in my library about people using the library as a space and materials to create. You wrote a book. Here comes the shameless plug, but I'm happy to do it because it's actually sounds very interesting. Can you tell us about that? Your book?
Sure. So last year, my book came out. It's called Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. I just have to say for everybody who's been slogging away at a book for a long time, this was a project that was 2 decades in the making. I started working on it in my first year of graduate school in 2003, 2004, and the book came out last year. I'm very proud of that, actually, of how long that it took me because, you know, we'll talk about the book in a second, but it's challenging being a scholar, having a full-time job. I got 2 little kids. This was a book that was a product of, you know, 5 a.m. wake-up calls before they were banging on my door and stuff like that. And so this is my big pitch to keep working. You'll get there, everybody, you know. But the book looks at the history of advice columns in the period that most people don't think about. That is before Dear Abby and Ann Landers. So I looked at advice columns from about 1895, when they really start to be a force in American newspapers, to around World War II, where you really see a paradigm change that eventually leads into Abby and Ann. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I argue is that advice columns were incredibly, they promoted a democratic discourse. You have people writing in over and over, sometimes writing to each other in ways that look uncannily like chat rooms or comment sections of the internet that we look at, that we interact with today. And they're using a language that we think was invented in the 90s with the rise of the World Wide Web, was really essentially established a century before in the pages of the newspaper. The idea of being an anonymous person who seeks advice, but also really seeks just to be heard and empathy, and to have other like-minded people kind of give credit to what they're saying. So if you read the book and you look at some of the entries, I do think any reader will be just kind of blown away by the way that it really feels like you're looking at Reddit or Quora or, you know, the comment section of old websites like Gawker and things like that. It really feels like an online community.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting. When I was thinking about this, I realized when I was a kid, I loved reading the newspaper. And the three things I would only read in the newspaper were the comics, Ann Landers, and anything to do with Patty Hearst. This just shows how old I am. In the early 70s, Patty Hearst kidnapping like fascinated me, but I'd read any article on that, then Ann Landers, and then the comics. I loved it. It's funny what you say about that, because you're absolutely right. And the thing with Ann Landers, though, is I was trying to think why I loved it so much. Like, what was it about it? It was just a clue into adult life. It was also questions for adult life, and also to see what somebody, again, like we said before, an authority would say, because she was an authority. And now when you can get obsessed with Reddit, someone ask a question like they would have to Ann Landers, and then you get all these comments, and sometimes you're like, oh, this is really interesting because there's a conversation happening. But then, and again, here I go, eventually it tires you out and devolves, because then it's just 80,000 voices who have all different opinions, and you're sort of like, I don't even remember what the question was anymore. Like, if you get caught in that, you know, there's a finite, whether it's unfair or not, version of Ann Landers, because it's just her voice, but and Reddit is more democratic, that has a lot, but there was something satisfying about having this finite situation, and the internet can be infinite anyway.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a perfect example of the decline, or at least the diffusion of authority in the culture that we live in. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this in the podcast, but one of the really interesting comparisons is Reddit's Am I the Asshole Forum? Right, where and you're either it's YTA, you're the asshole, or NTA, not the asshole. There's NO,
and both,
no assholes here, and then both, and BTA, yes, both the asshole. Exactly, right, okay. So, I mean, these are people writing in, and they may be really like they're in a jam, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They don't know what the answer is on something. And the thing with Anne is that she did. And Abby, they did, you know, give you that kind of authoritative voice, and there's your answer. But there are steps to that. You had to write your letter in. She had to choose it, right? Mm-hmm. Does it actually get published? There is good evidence that most advice columnists actually wrote back to all the letters that they got. They had a big staff. They had a lot of canned responses for very common answers. And so most people would get a response. But again, this is like the flip side of the beauty of the speed of the internet. Is here is a person suffering. I mean, maybe it's, you know, I'm dealing with a racial microaggression at work, or I'm afraid to come out to my parents. And then you get this immediate response from people. I mean, that is the potential to save lives, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that is a really remarkable thing. But going back to Anne and her authority, I think one thing that is really significant about advice columnists as a model is that her authority and the authority of advice columnists that came before her lies in her gender. general audience advice columns, we are talking largely about women who pioneered this path, right? And they said, you know, we are good at our jobs because we're women. And in fact, you hear all these stories about like Miss Lonely Hearts, like supposedly an advice columnist is a man pretending to be a woman. A man could never do what I do, right? And I think it is this one really fascinating place where women said, you know what? I'm not even getting into your gender games. This is just ours. Back off. This is ours. And they made a lot of money. They were real pioneers in celebrity journalism.
Yeah.
Remarkably successful, known nationally in some cases, globally. So it's this really remarkable example of where women leaned into that idea of self-journalism. They said, yeah. Oh yeah, we're doing this because we're women and we're rocking it. And I applaud them for that. It really, and you see, you know, again, you see sort of the remnants of this and the sort of the future versions of this, like momfluencers on Instagram, right? These are people who are saying, I'm an apologetically feminine, in some cases, very conservative, you know, icon that I want people to model their lives after. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, drawing on precedents that were established again 100 years ago in the pages of the newspaper.
I wonder if that has to do with a maternal thing, like the maternal advice giver. It'll be okay. You can come to me.
Here's an interesting thing about the advice columnists that I profiled, and I dug really deeply into their lives, is that, and I profiled three white columnists and one black columnist she's amazing. One of the most remarkable historical figures I've studied. I'll talk about her in a second. Princess Mysteria. We'll put a pin in Princess Mysteria. The three mainstream white columnists that I looked at all gave out, you know, I would say moderately conservative advice. Like, you know, you need to be beautiful for your husband. You need to run a tight ship at your house, but you are fundamentally a mother. You should be no nonsense, but you're rooted in the home. I think it's kind of like what you would, that kind of paradox of early 20th century womanhood, almost impossible to attain. Right. Mm-hmm. None of them could meet those standards themselves. They were all the breadwinners in their households. And so they were telling women to stay at home. They were telling women to, you know, focus on their families, be an icon of beauty and stability for your husband. But they were hiring people to take care of their children. If they had children, some of them didn't have children. So it's a perfect example of how they could not live up to their own conservative sort of, their requirements in ways that are similar to like a Phyllis Schlafly, in the 1960s and the 1970s, when you see all the backlash against the ERA. This is a woman who's telling women to stay at home while she herself is running a national campaign against the ERA. You know, we can all see the irony in that. But while those white columns were so conservative, I was so amazed to find this remarkable column in the Chicago Defender, which is a black weekly that ran between 1920 and 1930, penned by a woman named Princess Mysteria, who was a vaudeville mesmerist, which means that she read people's minds. Did a little bit of research on her and found that she, though she told us that she was, you know, born in India at the foot of a, you know, the mountaintop, she was actually part of the Great Migration. She was born in the South, came up to Chicago with her family, became a fixture on the vaudeville scene. And then even as she had this kind of exotic persona, she gave out this remarkably practical advice to women that prioritized safety and self-reliance and the protection of themselves over, for example, the maintenance of their marriage. So if, you know, white columnists like Dorothy Dix were saying, stay married no matter what, if a woman wrote into Princess Mysteria saying, my husband is a drunk and he's losing our money, divorce him, get out, take care of yourself. She encouraged people to divorce almost, you know, daily. Weekly in her column. Mm-hmm. And her priority was women's safety and women's self-reliance. And she is, I think, a real progenitor of what we today call intersectional feminism.
Wow. That's almost like more bold than Abby and Anne, because they would usually just say, talk to clergy. I'm not touching that one.
They did a lot of things that were pioneering. They talked about, Abby and Anne talked about AIDS before the president did, but you're right. I mean, and they were both also married with children and emphasized their chops as these sort of maternal icons. But Princess Mysteria is one of the coolest people in my book.
See, this is the thing I was talking about before. It's like a very specific story you're telling about advice columnists. But the more you talk about it, the farther the tentacles reach in terms of the subjects we cover. That's what I meant before about focusing on one thing. And then you think it's like such a niche thing, but then you learn so much about life and about roles we play and about society. I mean, Princess Mysteria sounds far more progressive than columnists I read in the 70s. She just went there where you'd think, and now Reddit would go where Princess Mysteria. I mean, it's very interesting.
I would almost disagree with that, because I think Reddit, like, there is this democratic aspect to it, but like the user base, I think, is like primarily men, and you get some threads where you're like, oh, you really see that user base coming out, right? So yeah, sometimes not so progressive, right?
Great point.
That's a good point, because I also was thinking when Julie was talking that when I read Reddit, I don't know who's talking. Like, I don't click on all their profiles. So I don't know if they're men or women or what their agenda is. And usually someone in there says, why are you asking for medical advice on Reddit? Like, there's always one of those.
Yeah.
Like, get off Reddit and go to the doctor.
Yes,
like,
yes.
And talk about the immediacy, you said, from Julia. Someone takes a picture, Julie, they take the picture of like a, you know, a growth on their foot. And they're like, what is this? And then Reddit weighs in. Mm-hmm. And the length of time it would take to write into an advice column is about an issue is a process, like you indicated. Really interesting. What's the title of the book again?
Interestingly, I will say there is an equivalent of that in advice columns, where people would write in and say, what is this plant? Or how do I formulate my child? Like, it was, they treated advice columns like the internet. and then people would respond with their suggestions and their answers. The book is called Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. Cool. It's from Oxford. It's also in our catalog, so people can borrow it from the New York Public Library.
Perfection. Well, I could talk about this forever. Thank you so much.
Good.
But I want to get to two things. First of all, do you have a book recommendation for us unrelated to your own that you're reading or have read recently that you want to tell people about?
You know, this is just, it's so interesting, because as somebody who reads for work, it can be so challenging to read for pleasure. But one of my New Year's resolutions has been to to immerse myself more in sort of the pleasure of fiction reading, which I felt like I'd really gotten away from. So I just read a book called Kevin Wilson called Nothing to See Here. Have you guys talked about that yet? Do you know that feeling when it's like 2 a.m. and you cannot put the book down, and then you finish it and you're like, oh, it's wonderful. And then you go to sleep. Oh, I love that feeling. And I actually feel like that is like a formative memory from my teen years, where I was like a very voracious reader. You know what I mean? So that's how I felt about this book. It's funny. I almost don't even want to describe it, because it kind of gives away the punchline of the story you get very early in it. So I almost don't want to give it away, like what the story is about. But I do want to say that it has one of the most finely drawn and likable heroines, anti-heroines that I've read in a while. And I think that's really like what kept me gripped into sort of what was going to happen. It's got a wonderful sense of irony and sarcasm while still being sort of deeply empathetic. So I highly recommend somebody starts reading it on a Friday so they can just eat it up over the weekend and be done with it by Sunday.
I see it across the desk at the library for sure.
Oh, really?
Nothing to See Here.
Kevin Wilson?
Kevin Wilson.
Okay.
Fabulous. We'll post that and your book in the blog post for the podcast.
All right.
Go ahead, Crystal.
Oh, I was going to say, like, hearing you speak does remind me of this a young adult book. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's called The Downstairs Girl by Stacey Lee, but the basic premise, it's a historical fiction book, is a teen who takes on this persona of like Miss Sweetie and writes this advice column that I think pushes back on a lot of sort of ideas of that time and kind of pushes for like more feminism and racial justice and things like that. But it was a really great like sweet historical fiction romance that came out a couple of years ago. But it just reminded me of that hearing you talk about the female advice columnists.
I'm going to my Simply E and I'm getting it right after.
It's a fun one, yeah.
Well, Crystal, you did your job.
You always have to recommend a book. Yes.
Right. I'm the librarian.
So we haven't done this in a while because we haven't had a guest in a while. So I'm thrilled that we are. But it's something we love to do. Do you have a little passage you can read to us from a book and we can see if we can guess the author, genre, subject matter, anything? It's just a free-for-all. And also, it's a good opportunity to hear somebody read, which I love.
I do. I loved this assignment. It was so fun to think about. I was like, I want to get them something that's like, that's hard, but that they could still get. It was so much fun to think about it.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Here we go. I'm gonna let her rip. And it was fun. Okay. I went to my little bookshelf and I pulled out something. Okay, here it is. Though I'd long been acquainted with the neighborhood, having now and then visited there, my closer association began 2 years ago when a friend bought a house on Willow Street. One mild May evening, he asked me over to inspect it. I was most impressed, exceedingly envious. There were 28 rooms, high-ceilinged, well-proportioned, and 28 workable marble-mantled fireplaces. There was a beautiful staircase floating upward in white, swan-simple curves to a skylight of sunny amber-gold glass. The floors were fine, the real thing, hard, lustrous timber, and the walls. In 1820, when the house was built, men knew how to make walls thick as a buffalo, immune to the mightiest cold, the meanest heat. French doors led to a spacious rear porch reminiscent of Louisiana, a porch canopied, completely submerged, as though under a lake of leaves by an ancient but admirably vigorous vine, weighty with grape-like bunches of wisteria. Beyond, a garden, a tulip tree, a blossoming pear, a perched black and red bird bending a feathery branch, a forsythia. In the twilight, we talked, my friend and I. We sat on the porch, consulting martinis. I urged him to have one more, another. It got to be quite late. He began to see my point. Yes, 28 rooms were a rather lot, and yes, it seemed only fair that I should have some of them. That's how I came to live in the yellow brick house on Willow Street.
Well, I gotta say, Crystal and I did an episode on cozy reading, and I was I had a very hard time figuring out what cozy was.
It made you angry.
And one of the things, which
I remember.
I had very mixed emotions. But one of the things I had come upon was like real estate, like talking about the coziest, sometimes going to sleep, I just think about houses and walking through rooms and how I would redo them. That was pretty hot, what you just read. And then when you said martini, that put the cherry on top because I was like, a martini in this house? I'm like, oh, it was heaven to hear.
In May with the wisteria. Oh, it's like redolent. I love it.
The marble, the staircase floating up. I mean, that is cozy, almost bordering on something less than cozy.
But, Frank, have you seen that SNL Zillow skits that is done in a really sexy way? I feel like you would resonate with that a lot, but that was excellent reading, by the way. It was beautiful.
That feels like fun. Do you have any ideas, Crystal? It's not Dickens. It's
contemporary, right? Because the way they talked about it was built in the 1800s made me think it was definitely in the past, plus the martini. I was like, this seems
right, exactly. I always go to Dickens first.
The martini is a real clue. A real clue.
Oh boy.
Oh, is it?
Is it? Is it?
The Thin Man.
Oh no, I've read those books and I love those books.
Well,
and
in the movies, they're always drinking martinis.
Yes, yes.
The martinis are real clue. That's my favorite drink.
Is it in the title, the martini? Are these drinkers? Oh, boy.
It's subtler than that. It's more subtle than that.
Subtle.
We always also go for Slavish clues. Like, we'll just ask. It's subtler than that. It does it.
Let me tell you.
James Bond.
Yeah.
Did you remember the street name? Willow?
Yes, Willow.
Okay.
I was paying attention to that, but I couldn't. It didn't. So Willow has. Is it in the title, Willow? Willow Street? No.
No.
It's not a children's book. So is it written in the last 20 years?
No.
But mid-century. Yeah.
About Giant House.
Was it made into a movie?
It should be.
Oh, okay.
Oh gosh, let's copyright that right now. It would be an amazing movie.
Is the house like a core character? Is like that? Is it?
Core character.
Really? Okay.
So when you read was sort of like the big setup for the story. This comes earlier in the book.
Something important is made in the house.
It's something not good. Fiction, obviously.
It's not like that house,
It is nonfiction.
It is nonfiction.
But that, something important was made in the house, so something good, and not like that murderer who killed a bunch of people in the Chicago world. Okay, not that one.
So is it a first person narrative of this person who made something in the house? Oh, wow. So it's an inventor, would you say? Inventor.
Liquor make? No, okay.
Liquor. Well, martini. Yeah. What are martinis?
Is it Willow Street, 28 rooms.
It's not an inventor, though. All right.
Not over the White House.
When you say something was made in this house,
I'm going to give you another hint, too.
Oh, okay. My God, please.
You're smart. Okay. You know what to do.
I worked in Brooklyn.
Okay.
10 years and have a great love of Brooklyn history.
Okay.
And I will say that something that was made in this book is not as tangible as you guys are thinking.
So Willow Street's in Brooklyn. Okay.
Oh my God, I live in Brooklyn. I'm failing this. They made some kind of history.
Sort of. You're closer. Sort of. Have you guys ever been to Brooklyn Historical Society? Everybody listening should go. It's an unbelievably beautiful building in Brooklyn Heights.
I should tell you, parenthetically, the man, Charles Booth, who did the stained glass windows in Brooklyn Historical, did the windows in Jefferson Market. So we have that connection. I don't have any idea. I have no idea.
I don't know either.
Now I'm going to show you the cover.
All right. Okay. We're giving in.
Oh.
Oh, A House on the Heights by Truman Capote, one of my favorite authors. See, that's a disappointment.
look how thin the book for our listeners. The book is incredibly thin. I think it's less than 50 pages long. If I didn't want to read from this, I would have used this as my book recommendation because it is the most delicious little read in the whole world. He lived in Brooklyn Heights while he was writing In Cold Blood. And he lived in the basement of this house on Willow Street, which is still there. People should go and look at it. It is so beautiful, but it is not yellow anymore. The most recent
yellow brick
just stripped it, unfortunately. Okay. It is one of the most stately mansions in New York City. And if you can peek in the back, you can still see the porch that reminds him of Louisiana. It's really remarkable. You turn around the corner and you are at the promenade, which is such a remarkable place to take in really the geographic history of New York and why this port was so important. You see sort of the opening to the lower bay. You see this massive deep water port. You see two waterfronts that shaped the sort of economic history of the city and this country and this world. It is like a real place to get deep about New York.
Wow. That was great. I mean, you're absolutely right, because I responded to the writing right away, and I love Truman Capote. In Cold Blood is one of my favorite books. Mm-hmm. And then you're right, the martini, the Southern references, all of it was there. Oh, you're good, Julie.
Who was he drinking with?
Great question. He was drinking with a man named Oliver Wood, who was an incredibly a successful stage designer. He's a set designer on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And this was a period, it was a little bit later than this really interesting period in the 1940s where a group of people lived in a building that no longer exists and formed this great artistic commune called February House. And there's a lovely book written by Cheryl Tippins, another book recommendation, talks about that it was like Gypsy Rose Lee, Carson McCullers, Auden, Paul Bowles, like a bunch of really awesome people lived there, and they were all sort of feeding off of each other's creativity, and they would have these salons mm-hmm. there. And then the house got torn down when they built the BQE.
What's the name of that book?
February House.
Oh, okay. I know you interviewed Hugh Ryan, who wrote When Brooklyn Was Queer. Does he talk about that house in that book?
He does.
I read about it.
We're queer. And it's like a dream. It's like an artist's dream. You know what I mean? And it's just a year that they're there.
Exactly. He does talk about that because all these incredible people came together and it was for this commune, which does sound like a dream, but it only lasted like a year or so.
Yep.
Shows something about the volatility of human beings, but it's still super fascinating. Oh, wow.
Lovely book. Wow. Made into a musical, actually.
Really?
Yes.
What musical?
I think it's called February House. Oh, it was at the Public or maybe the Cherry Lane Theater.
Oh.
Something like that. But it has a beautiful score.
Wow, you just pushed all of my buttons.
Yay!
All of them. All right, I can't take any more of this. It's too much. It's too, I feel almost intoxicated with literature and
electrified. Right.
Julie, thank you so much. This is incredible. All right, Crystal, I have my own set, but I'll defer to you. Do you want to give us a reading before we leave?
No. You should do it from your set. Break them in. Yeah. But you have to. Did you give it a moon bath?
I didn't know.
Okay, so you have to, apparently, I Googled this. So just knock on the cards to clear it of bad energies and then draw a card or whatever. You could give it a moon bath or a salt bath, apparently.
I can't open them. Julie's, Crystal started this ASMR thing and then she ran that course and now apparently we're doing tarot cards. I mean, what I love about tarot cards is it mixes art, because like cards are beautiful and I love artistic expression with what? Advice. Like we all want advice and mm-hmm. like astrology and all this stuff. You can, even if it doesn't make sense, it's like interesting to think about what something may mean outside of you, like asking advice of a columnist. It all comes together. Love it. All right. I'm just going to make, all right, here we go.
Did you shuffle them? Did you knock on them?
I'll do it. I did knock on them.
Okay, good.
What is this? I don't even know what it is. What? Oh, I think this is like Seven of Cups.
Uh-huh.
Is that seven? No, that's six. Oh my God, I'm blind. It's six.
Okay.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four, six. All right. Six of Cups. See, I didn't even prepare. I don't know how to do this. Now I can look in the little book.
Yes.
Julie's like, what are they doing here?
We're very new to this.
Oh, here, three. Okay. Jesus. Everything is so... All right, Six of Cups. Now this will, I guess we can say, this is going to be sort of the theme of all three of our day, our upcoming days, all three of us. So Cups, six. It says, children in an old garden, their cups filled with flowers. Which relates to what we just heard too. Divinatory meanings, a card of memories and of the past. For example, reflecting on childhood, happiness, enjoyment, but coming rather from the past, things that have vanished.
Oh.
Another reading reverses this, suggesting new relations, new environment, and new knowledge.
Okay.
I have that's a feeling perfect. That's exactly what we got in this podcast.
It is almost eerie. How I almost have a little chills, right?
Yeah.
Exactly what we talked about. We talked about the past and then we talked about producing an image.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Wow. I'm getting chills now too. Are you getting chills, Crystal?
Yes, these cards know us. I'm scared.
All right. I'm into this thing. It's so, they're so pretty and they're so much fun to think about. And it's so great to see these reactions. this was beyond a pleasure. Mm-hmm. JG, thank you
so much for having me. It was so lovely talking about this stuff with you guys.
And I miss having guests.
Shamelessly promote my book. Thank you.
Hey, you know, I love it because you work for New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. We work for New York Public Library. We love New York Public Library. It's all about New York Public Library. and I just love people who follow their passions creatively mm-hmm. and make things happen, which you did. Yeah. And as you exhorted the listeners to do the same, which is wonderful.
Super inspiring. Yes. In 20 years, so I still have time. I can get that book out, right?
Right. Start now. No, I think that actually describes so many. I mean, that is, as a relatively new person to the library, describes mm-hmm. my colleagues. Is everybody feels incredibly passionately about the work that they do. And we have so many people who do different things at the library, but mm-hmm. that is, I think, that ties all of our colleagues together. So yay, NYPL.
All right. Perfect. Thank you so much, Julie. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library, please visit nypl.org. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Hilarious and Crystal Chen.